This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As of September of this year, 109 people in Vermont had died of an opioid overdose. That's about 25% higher than the previous 3 years. It seems very likely that Vermont will break its previous record for fatal opioid-related deaths, 130, set in 2018. At the same time, the number of people receiving residential treatment dropped by 63% in the second quarter of 2020, according to an October report from the Vermont Department of Health. The number of people in intensive outpatient treatment was down about 61%. So it seems clear that many people are struggling with substance abuse right now, if we think of residential treatment and overdose fatalities as really just the visible or reportable tips of the addiction iceberg. We want to talk about it today. We're going to hear from some people who work in recovery and treatment, and also from people who are living in recovery themselves, about what this year has been like. We'll talk about what needs aren't being met and also what is going well, where there has been innovation that could be helpful moving forward. Julia Larson is joining us first today. She's the supervisor of the opioid response team at Turning Point Center of Bennington. That's about one of a dozen recovery centers around the state that are part of the Vermont Recovery Network. They're peer-led, non-residential centers for people in recovery to access services, social networks, group meetings, get support finding jobs, and more. And they're also places for family members of people who are dealing with addiction to also find support. Julia Larson, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you just talk broadly about what you're seeing at Turning Point Center of Bennington this year? You know, what kinds of issues are coming up, how people are accessing your resources if they can't just drop in, and you know, how things are going?
So typically we would have people come into the center, but because of COVID restrictions, we really had to limit people and the amount of people. We're a recovery center, so we're a safe place for people to come in and spend, you know, a couple of hours doing groups and meeting with recovery coaches. It's changed since COVID. We have to do, you know, there are a lot of precautions, and we have to meet with people one-on-one and schedule that in advance. We've also noticed a decrease in the number of individuals that are coming for services because we're not open. We don't have the open door policy we had. We are still open, but I believe because of COVID, people are in fear of coming out and coming directly to the center. So most of the meetings that we're having are currently held by Zoom or by phone.
Worth just stating it pretty directly, just because people aren't coming doesn't mean they're not in need.
Correct. We have a program that we run through the emergency room at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center, and we're still seeing people coming through the emergency with substance use disorder that aren't receiving help because they're isolated in hotels, lack of transportation, you know, a multitude of different reasons. The need is still there. I think what has happened is we've created kind of like this system where people are in hotels, their basic needs are being met. And so while we provided this great resource and we've been able to help people end homelessness, you know, and lack of residents in Vermont, people aren't having to seek out inpatient treatment beds as soon as they would if they didn't have a place to go or if they didn't have somebody to come to. Sometimes we're like the last resort, but right now we're not really seen as the last resort, I guess.
Is that good? I mean, it's certainly good for people to have somewhat more stable housing. And actually, Julia, maybe you could talk a little bit about the connection between housing instability and opioid use disorder as you see it among the people that you work with.
So I think that, you know, when we talk about people with substance use disorder, it's different for everyone.
Right.
But when we provide resources and, you know, there basically needs to be like a need. If all your needs are met and you're financially stable and somebody has you know, is paying your rent and you're getting food every day, you're not going to go and look for those resources yourself. So we've tried to create different things. We have a Messages for Me platform that we also work with the hospital that sends, like, inspirational text messages that tries to catch people and help people through recovery, sends out inspirational messages and just tries to share hope in this time of kind of disconnection.
For you mentioned people who are living in hotels, and you know there has been a big push during the COVID-19 pandemic to get people who didn't have stable housing into somewhat stable housing, and then there's an even greater push to get them to more stable housing, so that the opioid, you know, when we have the end of the COVID-19 pandemic, it doesn't just result in suddenly a lot of people losing their housing. What effect does having stable housing have on someone who is working to get into and stay in recovery?
I think if you are in a place that is positive and is there aren't available substances, it's very challenging in early recovery if substances are available very quickly. So I believe that I think housing people is great. People need housing. They need help getting back on their feet, getting help reestablished, finding jobs, all those things. I think that there just needs to be more of a connection met between what people's needs are besides housing and basic needs. Maybe like an assessment level of need for each person that's seeking housing or permanent housing. Like, what is each person's individual reason for needing housing?
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe help address the issues. We disperse, distribute Narcan bags are provided by ADAP. They're harm reduction kits, and they provide Narcan, a bunch of different information, and we add other resources and local information, and we hand them out at hotels and different areas around Bennington and to other organizations. And those are life-saving tools for an opiate overdose. But we would also like to make that face-to-face connection, because we're people in recovery, and we want to show people that there's a way out, that it's possible. Opioid overdose is 100% preventable. And we just want to let people know that this service is here and available.
Julia, I'm really glad you mentioned harm reduction, because that's one of the things that I wanted to talk about and ask you a little bit about how you're dealing with that, perhaps a little differently at Turning Point Center right now. Last week in one of the governor's press conferences, we heard from the commissioner of the Department of Mental Health, Sarah Squirrel, and she advised Vermonters who are using to not do it alone. She said, find a safe space or call a trusted person. But that seems really hard given the isolation that so many people are dealing with already and the governor's orders not to get together with people from other households. So how are you advising people who do use on how to do it as safely as possible?
Right. It sounds like a mixed message, right? Get together, but don't get together.
Right.
And how we do that is we provide fentanyl test strips, we provide Narcan, and we tell people do not use alone. You know, maintain social distancing. Maintain, you know, good hygiene, wear a mask, but make sure that people are in a safe place and that somebody is there with them. You know, Narcan will work if somebody's there to help assist, but if there's nobody there and there's nobody to call 911, there's no options. So people can still use safely. That doesn't, you know, we don't want 10 people gathering together, but have one safe person that's not using come to you in a safe place where you are using, and then use the safety measures that we're using for COVID-19.
And do you think people are doing that?
I do know that people are doing their best. There's a lot of people that are following the procedures that come regularly and get supplies from us and ask for more supplies. I think that people are.
You know, when we look at the statistics around overdose deaths, and we see that they're up significantly from the previous several years, from what you know, I mean, I know that we certainly don't have the details on everybody who died and the circumstances under which they died. But I'm wondering if you think that that lack of access to somebody who has Narcan is a greater factor this year than in previous years. You know, like we could look at that number and say, maybe it's the stress of the pandemic. Maybe it's the strain on financial resources and social resources and all of the other things. But you just mentioned that it could also be if you're using alone and you overdose and there's nobody there with Narcan to help, that's also obviously a factor. So how do you think that plays into what we're seeing in terms of people dying of overdoses this year?
I think that this year people have gone through the definition of the definition of recovery is connection. So if you disconnect people from each other and you isolate them wherever they're living, whether that's their own apartment, a hotel, with their grandparents, if you disconnect them from their social circle, their family circle, their work circle, and people that have long-term sobriety are struggling this year. And I think that using harm reduction methods are safer than using nothing at all. We know how to protect ourselves from COVID. We can do that safely and effectively. And Narcan can always be accessed through the Turning Point Center.
And do you think some of the people who are dying just aren't with other people? They don't have access to Narcan?
I don't know how to answer that because I'm not sure. I think that this has just been a horrific year for people that struggle, whether that's with mental health, substance use. We have, you know, this is an opiate related, but we have people that are saying, you know, I'm drinking at 11 o'clock in the morning because my kids are driving me nuts. And I notice that I'm using this as a coping skill. Mm-hmm. Do I have a problem? So I think on a broader range, people are, if they're not isolated, they're on top of each other at home. So that's another stressor. There's financial stressors. I think Narcan is available and it's widely accessible, but it's also up to individuals to want to seek out getting Narcan and seek out treatment and want to get help.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that people are drinking more or drinking differently, and we've certainly seen that reflected in numbers from the state of alcohol sales, which are up significantly. And up significantly, even with the closure of bars and restaurants, which typically do a lot of alcohol sales for the state. And so I'm wondering, you know, are you talking with people who are finding it easier to access pills or heroin or alcohol or other things that they can use, you know, substances to use? Are they finding it in some ways easier to access that than to access the social and emotional and other types of resources that could help with substance use?
I think sometimes those are the Band-Aids before they can get to the other places. So those are the quick fix, make a 5-minute phone call or, you know, drive a mile down the street to buy alcohol. I think that the choice is theirs to make whether they want to access services because we're available, we're ready. We have trained recovery coaches. We're training more recovery coaches to help for when the pandemic is over. So I think, you know, I think that it's up to individuals to try and make an active choice in their life also to want recovery and realize that, you know, this is behavior different than what I would do. And now is a great time for people to take advantage of substance use programs because there are openings. Usually this time of year we have wait lists, and right now I don't believe there are wait lists in residential treatment centers.
Hmm. You know, I mentioned that Turning Point Center and the recovery centers in Vermont are generally peer-led, and you said, you know, this is something we are dealing with. This is something that you personally are dealing with. How are you coping?
I am. I'm a person in long-term recovery from opiates, so I deal with things a little bit differently. I deal by giving back and by trying to help my community, and that helps me get through.
Has this year been challenging for you in terms of your recovery?
It hasn't been challenging for my recovery. It's been challenging for me emotionally to see so many people struggling.
What's
been challenging?
What's working well do you think? I mean, you mentioned that in some cases, people who work at Turning Point, for example, are going to directly to people who would normally maybe drop into the center or get resources at the center. You're reaching out to them instead and doing a lot more one-on-one. Are there things that are going well that you think could carry forward post-pandemic?
There are. I think that we've built good relationships with our community partners. So we have a safe network of MAT providers. We can, you know, if somebody shows up at our emergency department in withdrawal, they can access MAT services and start their recovery from that emergency room visit and go forward from there. And then we can follow up with them and call them for the next 10 days and get them engaged in recovery support, help expedite them, facilitate their treatment, help advocate for them, help communicate with family members about different ways that they can interact and help and not enable. So I think there are a lot of things that are working really well. I think that, you know, we're starting a new program in due to start in January where we'll actually be paged to overdoses where people are refusing to go to the hospital after being Narcan'd. So if they receive a dose of Narcan and then they don't use the ambulance to go to the hospital, a recovery coach that's been specially trained will go out and try and talk them into, you know, the process. And what are their fears? Well, why don't they want to receive medical treatment? Why don't, you know, where are they at that day in their recovery? Or are they ready for recovery? Is there harm reduction that we can do? What can we do to keep people safe until, you know, they decide that they want recovery in their life so we don't have as many opiate fatalities?
And you mentioned MAT, just for people who aren't as aware of the acronyms, that's medication-assisted treatment.
Correct.
Yeah. We got a question from Carlos who says, if someone calls 211, can they go into a detox program immediately? Do you know, Julia?
So 211 can give information and resources, but it depends on the – it depends – there's so many variables. It depends on the facility, insurance. But you can go to your local emergency room and access services. I don't know, to be honest, if you can go directly from 211 to a facility.
We'll see if we can get an answer to that, but certainly 211 is a great way to a great resource, yeah, for people who just need to get connected to something or don't know, you know, who do I call, what do I call? You can call 211 for all kinds of connections to resources that you might need that are COVID related or otherwise. Lots of people who can connect you to the right resources, so that might be a great start. Greg is calling in from Eden. Hi, Greg. Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for having this forum. I just want to say that I recognize the power of the isolation during this time period, especially for addicts in general and addicts in recovery. I do want to just make a quick plug for Narcotics Anonymous of Northern Vermont, the CVANA area of Narcotics Anonymous. We are still having meetings using a combination of Zoom and some in-person renegade meetings, if you will, but most of our meetings are on Zoom. That meeting list can be found at cvana.org. And once again, thank you both for having this forum, and let's hope we all get through this challenging time together.
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. Let me ask you, when you do Zoom meetings, do you find those feel good? Do they feel different than in-person meetings? I mean, how are you managing to get what you need out of a Zoom meeting?
Yeah, you know, Zoom meetings are definitely different. They're definitely challenging. And they, they're an obstacle for all of us pursuing our recovery. But it is so nice to see and hear people that I know from CVANA and from meetings around the North Country. So, you know, positives and negatives, we need to adapt during this challenging time, and I think we can do it if we use our resources.
Yeah, Greg, thank you very much for letting us know about that. We will put CVANA, the Champlain Valley Area Narcotics Anonymous website, among the resources on our website at vpr.org. Before we come back to Julia Larson, let's talk now with Ashley Lawyer. Ashley lives in Burlington. She's a mom, and she's been in recovery for 4 years now and wanted to talk with us today about what she's been experiencing. Ashley, I really appreciate you being willing to share your life and your story with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've been in recovery for 4 years now. Can you tell me a little bit about what your experience was before you entered recovery with substance use disorder?
Sure. So I started using regularly when I was about 19, and it started with opiates. And then I continued to use opiates for the next 10 years, off and on. And then I quit using those, and I started drinking, and I was addicted to alcohol for 3 years. It was really hard. I mean, I quit 8 times. I don't really know if it's really, now that I'm actually in recovery, it wasn't like, I just kind of took breaks, I guess. And I would sweat it out on people's couches, but I always ended up back to it. But I'm proud to say that I've been sober from heroin and opiates for 5 years and alcohol for 4.
Congratulations. That's great, Ashley.
Thank you.
What has this year been like in terms, I mean, the number of stresses on everybody in all kinds of ways has been immense. And, you know, for those in recovery, it's not necessarily that there are more challenges, but perhaps different challenges, or, you know, maintaining that sort of state that you've been in may be harder for some people and may not be harder for some people. What's it been like for you to try to deal with the pandemic?
Well, what's been hard for me was I was in school full time when the pandemic started, and I had to remove my daughter from school. She has a lot of health issues. She was born 10 weeks premature, so she had to be out of school from February to September. So I got dismissed from college, which was really difficult to deal with. I was able to get back in, but it was still a struggle and a little bit of a disappointment because, I mean, I didn't want to get dismissed, but my daughter's father is not involved at all, and I literally had her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Ashley, when you say you got dismissed, you mean because you couldn't attend classes, you couldn't do your work because of childcare?
Right. I didn't have it for her.
Yeah.
Right. So I had to get dismissed because I'm majoring in psychology, and I can't, like, sit and read and retain any of that information. So I'm starting again in January, hopefully. Yeah, everything kind of goes the way I'm planning. But and then just keeping my daughter healthy was always my concern. And her being out of school as long as she was really difficult to deal with because of her prematurity, she does have some delays. And she was unable to work with people that she needed to work with. And luckily, she didn't go backwards at all. We were able to make sure she kept trucking forward. But that was a really big fear. It was hard having her out of school for that long.
Oh boy, no kidding, and concerning. I mean, if you have somebody who's immunocompromised and you're worried about their health, certainly in a global pandemic. I mean, boy, what a stress that must be.
Yeah, and she catches lung viruses very easily. This year, this past January, she was in the hospital for 8 days, and she had 3 different lung viruses. And like, so that was another huge concern. Like, as soon as I found out that it affected the respiratory system, I was just like immediate panic mode. I called all of her doctors, like I got on it, but it was definitely very scary. And it was scary, I mean, even to let her go to a store. Like, I didn't know what could happen. I'm feeling more better about it now, because I feel like there's more information. I'm kind of a philosophical person. I need to have answers. So like when people are like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen, we don't know what's going to happen, that was really hard for me to deal with.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think all of us are like, if somebody could just tell me, you know, we're all sort of all the way through this thinking, I need more information, and, you know, how am I going to get through this, and what is the explanation? And yeah, certainly having more answers is absolutely helpful.
Yeah.
What about now? I mean, in terms of continuing to move through, you know, you've been in recovery for 4 years. Are you finding your recovery challenged by all of those stressors that you just talked about? Or is that one factor that is just not, it's dealing with recovery, staying sober is not a factor in the, all of the stress of the pandemic? I don't know. What about for you?
I mean, I have had triggers and cravings, but I am heavily involved with Lund, the Lund Family Center. I lived there for a year, and I've been still doing groups. I do four groups a week plus clinical work, and I have a family educator. So though having those things during this time has been able to definitely keep me at a balance. It definitely hasn't been something on the top of my list. I'm more concerned like about school and my daughter and things like that, which, I mean, I never thought I would reach that point ever in my life. So
you didn't think you'd reach that point?
No, I accepted probably around the age of like 21 that I would die drunk or high in a ditch somewhere before I was 35. And I was okay with that. And then I got told I couldn't have children, and I was like, oh, that's even better, because now I don't ever have to worry about having a child. But then I ended up getting pregnant. I found out I was pregnant at 5.5 months, and then I had her a month later. So in the beginning it was really hard, but not now. Like, it's just easier for me to deal with my cravings doing the work that I'm doing. I do a lot of drawing and crafty type things to keep my hands busy, so that's helpful too. I have a 5-year-old.
Yes, I have a 4-year-old, so I can sympathize with what that's like.
Oh, Ashley, man, she fills the shoes.
No kidding. What would you say to someone who's in the position that you were? I mean, in some ways, it sounds like that surprise pregnancy jolted you out of a path that you said you were happy to be on. But there are a lot of people on that path right now who say, "Yep, I'm fine with where this is going," like you were, and you're not. You're on the other side of that in some ways now. What do you say to people who are feeling the way you did then?
If I can do it, anybody can. I'm a very transparent person. I don't lie. Like, it's not an easy journey. There's going to be challenges. Like, I've had 5 friends overdose in the past, not even 2 years. And so, like, there's just a lot to deal with emotionally, because you're actually going to have to feel emotions. But once you get to a point, like, it's worth the work. It's worth the time that you're putting into it. Because even though my life it's far from perfect. I have problems just like everybody else does. Some of mine seem more intense because I'm learning how to deal with emotions still. But I am so happy that, like, I can sit in a moment with my daughter and just look at her smiling and laughing and be happy in that moment. I can be mindful. And those are the things that are important to me. And you can get to that point if you just do the work and stay connected.
So it's worth it. You say it's been worth it for you to get
Absolutely.
To the other side of that.
Absolutely. My daughter is thriving. I didn't think she would make it to age 5. I mean, she's doing amazing. I'm doing amazing. It's nice to be not hungover or dope sick when I wake up in the morning. But like I said, I still do have cravings and triggers and things. But I've done so much work on myself that I'm able to curb those, so I don't let them take over like they used to.
In fact, Ashley, one of the reasons why you were willing to talk to us today on the show and share what you went through is because you do think about other people who are going through that, right? I mean, that's part of it is, you said you're an open book, because if it helps somebody see the next step or what's on the other side, that's worth it to you.
Absolutely. And if I can, like, help in any way, like, I am happy to, because it's hard. And I remember being told so many times, like, you can't do it by yourself. And I never believed it until I actually got help. And then I realized how many people you actually need around you and how it's okay to ask for that help. Like, you got to put your pride aside in a way, which is difficult for people to do. But once you reach out, I mean, there's just a community of people out there waiting for you to just grab you in and be like, all right, we're here for you. What do you need from us? And that's never happened to me before in my life. And I really clung to it. And that's why I've stuck with Lund as long as I have, because the groups are just very important to me. I'm staying connected with women in recovery, mothers, so, like, I can have conversations with women about motherhood and the things that they go through with their children, really, in those levels. And the Lund program is very intense. Living through that and being able to make it to, like, graduation was a very big deal. So,
well, Ashley, thank you for speaking with us, and congratulations on your success. And I hope trying to deal with parenthood and schooling goes well when you start that up again in January. I appreciate your time and your sharing.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being on your show.
That's Ashley Lawyer. Ashley's a mom in Burlington and a student. She's been in recovery for 4 years. Julia Larson, did that resonate for you? You know, I mean, Ashley talked about a lot of different things, but also that importance of continuing to have support and a support network around you. And that's frayed for some people. But, you know, a lot of people like Ashley and some of the other people we've been hearing from today are saying they're still finding it because it is crucial.
It is. It absolutely is. It is the foundation of recovery, is that support network that you build. And like she said, there are, you know, I give people my cell phone number. They can call anytime because I will always be available for somebody when they're ready. I think that routine is so important in early recovery, and that's another obstacle that the pandemic has kind of thrown up in the air, is you get used to a certain schedule and then all of a sudden everything is different. It's not just one part of your life, but everything is different. So I think that starting a new routine and a healthy routine, you know, instead of when you have some type of thought, change the thought, which will change your actions, which will change your character and change your behavior. And, you know, it's really important to get connected to resources. We work really closely with the Vermont Recovery Network and VAMHAR, which is we do a lot of different trainings with, as well as ADEP, which is the Department of Health. And without their support helping us, we wouldn't be able to help the people we help. So we, you know, even as peers in recovery, we rely on different tools as well, both in our personal and professional lives.
And joining us now is Greg Tatro. He's president and founder of Jenna's Promise. Based in Johnson, it offers sober housing, treatment services, a support community, and a work program for those in recovery. Greg, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So, you know, we've been talking with Julia, we've been talking with Ashley and others about what is challenging, what's working, what the workarounds are. You actually, I think, just started Jenna's Promise, right? This is a fairly new organization. So how are you addressing the needs of your community and the recovery community and launching a new venture in the midst of a pandemic?
Well, we work closely with the North Central Vermont Recovery Center out of Morrisville. Daniel Franklin's the executive director up there, and he does a great job. But we do more assistance with sober living, and right now, because we are in the midst of getting everything going, so that's kind of our project right now, to financially assist people from inpatient into sober living. And so far, we've helped about 80 people get into sober living, and some we've helped get jobs. That's kind of what we're doing now. Our Jenna's House is hosting AA meetings and NA meetings, but that's through the Recovery Center. We just let them use the space.
So when in terms of sober housing, you know, are you finding that people, that there's, I mean, obviously there's a need for it, but are you finding people right now looking for it more? We were talking earlier with Julia about some of the people who she works with who are in hotels and other kinds of living situations, which are not always conducive to sober living. And so, you know, I'm curious about how that's been working for you and the people who you're serving through this sober housing.
Well, we first of all, we believe that sober housing in a safe place to live for 30 or 60 days until people get on their feet again is the critical path that we're missing. I don't believe everybody understands that when someone's an inpatient and then they go back to the same place that they came from, their chances of success are smaller. So we believe sober living is the missing link, and we're pushing that in the governments to try to get them to understand that the revolving door of inpatient could be cut down by giving people a safe place to live and work. And that's kind of what Jenna's Promise is about. So we've helped a number of people in that area, and it's going pretty good. ADAPT gave us a grant that's helping us a lot, and we put quite a bit of our own money into it also.
Yeah, and ADAPT, just, you know, for people who are wondering, again, it's the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program through the Health Department, which, you know, Julie has been talking about as well. Greg, I'm going to ask you to just briefly disconnect, and we're going to call you back or get you connected again, because your line is really difficult, and I really want to hear what you're saying. So we're going to disconnect you for a moment and then come back to you in just a minute. But
is this better now? Or?
Yeah, that's better. Were you on speakerphone?
I was.
Oh, yeah. Good. Glad you're off the microphone. Thank you.
Okay.
So let's, in the meantime, though, stay with us, Greg, but we're going to go to Lee, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Lee. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I work at a nonprofit transportation agency here in Middlebury. And part of what we do is we do provide transportation for people who live in Addison County to various appointments. And some of those appointments are actually up to the Howard Center and down in Rutland at Westridge, which are methadone clinics. One of the things that we found that can be a little challenging now with the COVID-19 experience that we're going through is we're experiencing limited resources now when it comes to drivers, our volunteer drivers. So we don't have as many drivers now as we used to be able to bring clients to those appointments. And then what we used to be able to do is drive, like if we had three different clients going to the same location, we could put them in the same vehicle and they could all go up at the same time. Unfortunately, we're unable to do that at this point. So I just wanted to explain that we're an excellent resource, but we are also from another perspective, we're experiencing some difficulties too with this COVID-19 situation.
Yeah, Lee, that's so interesting because it's, you know, one of those sort of knock-on effects that you wouldn't necessarily see as that middle link in terms of getting people access to methadone and other medication-assisted treatment. So from what you're talking to people about who are in that situation, are they then not getting their methadone or are they finding other ways to get it? I mean, is there a workaround or is this an impediment to getting treatment from what you're experiencing?
I don't think it's an impediment. There have been some challenges, obviously. But the clinics have also, from what I understand, have also been flexible in their treatment. So where before, you know, a person may have to go up every day, 7 days a week, to get their methadone dose, some of the clients have been able to do take-homes. So they're not actually having to go as often. So that's been a big help, but again, with a limited number of drivers, it does make it challenging to schedule those appointments at times.
Yeah, Lee, thank you for letting us know about that situation. It's interesting to hear from you. I appreciate it. Julia Larson, are you sensing something like that as well for people who you work with in Bennington?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of the resources that we typically that we could rely on pre-COVID, they all are slight, you know, everyone has that slight crunch. Like our volunteer staff has been cut dramatically because of health concerns where they can't come and be exposed to the public. And I know for some of our community partners that they feel frustration because they want to be able to provide resources and just like this, the rights that he was talking about. I mean, that's very, very important in early recovery is that consistency and maintaining the schedule and making sure you keep those appointments. And, you know, that leads to frustration on the person and more anxiety. And it's definitely harder in the COVID world because we have less people to do a really, really big job. But I think that we're adapting and we're doing what we can. And I think that we're working well, trying to figure out what we need to do and where we need to go.
We got a note from Jessica in Johnson. She's a coordinator for Healthy Lamoille Valley Coalition. And she wrote in to say, I would encourage people to connect with their prevention coalitions working to prevent substance misuse and support families. Most regions have coalitions that have a variety of ways to get involved. Getting involved can help provide purpose and meaning during this time while contributing to the overall wellness of many in the community. Greg Tatro, you know, we were talking a little bit about how Jenna's Promise is pretty new. And, you know, you say on the website of Jenna's Promise that it comes out of some personal experience. And we hear that from so many, including Julia and others in these community centers and recovery centers. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your personal experience with substance use disorder and how that has then motivated and pushed you to do the work that you're doing now?
Sure. Well, we lost Jenna in February of 2019 to an overdose. And, I found her in our house. And
is Jenna your daughter?
Jenna was our daughter, yes. So we, you know, that was, that's a tough thing. And a lot of people are dealing with it. This year, our overdose, the rate is way up, I think probably because of the pandemic, but it's a tough road for people and families too at the same time. We fought this disease with Jenna for about 6.5 years, and at the last go-around, she went to an inpatient and finally went to a sober living house and New Hampshire, and she was doing really well. She was almost into it 60 days, and then some of her old friends or dealers and picked her up there, and 4 days later, she was gone. So people in recovery, you know, I guess the one thing I would say is, you know, don't cross that line again. You come up to the decision whether to or not, then, stay away, because the next dose could be your last one. So that's, it was a trying time. I don't wish it on anybody, but
no.
A lot of families are dealing with it.
So is that one of the reasons why sober housing is so important to you and to the mission of your organization?
We do believe that's part of the solution, because the average person goes in and out of treatment, inpatient, 8 times. And a lot of times, government and state insurances are covering the cost of that. And we feel that when you dump them right back into the streets or the same place they came from, they're just going to be back in inpatient in another few months. So if we can get people a safe place to live, get on their feet, get them working, and get them back into society, and we feel we would cut the overdose death rate considerably, and government spending would be cut considerably.
Greg, you're very understated in what you talk about, how you talk about what this has been like for your family, and you said something like it's been a tough time or a challenging time, and yeah, I think that's certainly an understatement, but I'm wondering if you have advice for family members who are dealing with this. You know, we've talked a lot about resources for people in recovery, but both for what Julia Larson does and what you do, part of the puzzle also is helping family members who are dealing with this. So if there are people out there whose family members are in active addiction or who are in recovery and the family wants to support them, what advice do you have?
Well, I would get the first thing I would do is find your local recovery center, because they do have family programs there, and they do a good job with it. Jenna's Promise, we also help. My wife, Dawn, takes calls from families and people who are suffering from substance use, misuse, and she kind of helps them, leads them in the right directions, get them connected, and she takes calls anytime, all night, weekends, and whatever we can do to help people. But reach out. Don't be afraid. Part of Jenna's Promise is stop whispering. Let's speak loudly about our problem here, and then we can work on it together. And don't be ashamed. Reach out, stand up and get some help, and maybe it'll help other people too. So that's kind of what we think.
Well, Greg, I appreciate you talking with us today, sharing your story and also your resources. Thank you very much for joining the program.
Thank you.
Greg Tatro is the president and founder of Jenna's Promise. It's based in Johnson, and it offers sober housing, treatment services, and a support community and work program for those in recovery. Julia Larson has also been with us all this hour. Julia is supervisor of the opioid response team at Turning Point Center of Bennington, one of about a dozen recovery centers around the state that are part of the Vermont Recovery Network, peer-led non-residential centers for people in recovery to access services, social networks, group meetings, support finding jobs, and more. And they also support family members of people who are dealing with addiction to also find support. Julia, thank you very much for spending the hour with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we will have resources up at vpr.org. Click on Vermont Edition if you need help and access to resources.